Hello, and welcome to Animal Companions. This is Joyce Vesper, your volunteer broadcaster for Sun Sounds of Arizona, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading another chapter from Caleb Carr's book, My Beloved Monster, Masha, the Half-Wild Rescue Cat Who Rescued Me, and if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles from newsletters and magazines. We're going to start today's readings with Caleb Carr's story about his cat, Masha, in the book, My Beloved Monster, Masha, the Half-Wild Rescue Cat Who Rescued Me. In the last chapter, we learned that Caleb thought that he'd lost Masha, but under a rainy, full August moon, he saw her on a skinny maple tree branch, scared and needing to be rescued. And now we start Chapter 13, Wounds of a Warrior Queen. It might take Masha more hours to pull herself together enough to even try to come down from her perch. If she was hurt, she might not make it, and a fall from the tree trunk itself would land her right on the rocks. She was smart enough to know not to even try such a dangerous move in the rain, involving, as it would, creeping down the moistened tree trunk backwards with her claws. So-called domesticated cats do not have the reversible ankles on their hind feet that their ancient ancestors, along with a couple of extant species of bigger cats, did and do, which allowed and allow them to turn around and dash down trees head first. I definitely have to go up after her, as I'd already determined, which presented other problems. Even assuming I could get the heavy metal stepladder that I'd remembered was on the porch down to this spot, I would have to find a place for it, fold it against the tree so that its 2 feet were level and secure enough to hold my weight without slipping downhill. That would mean moving some of the big rocks on the upper side of the tree, and when I examined the ground, I saw that it would be no small job, especially in the rain. But then I looked up at Masha again, and I saw her anxiously and uncertainly watching me and said, "Okay, Mosh, I'm going to get the ladder. I'll be right back." She knew those two words well, right back, from when I made runs down to the local store, so I figured she'd be okay for several minutes, that it would take me to go to the porch, put my cane and flashlight down, shoulder the ladder, and return without falling and sliding down the lawn into the bushes and the rocks. I knew it was a slightly crazy idea. I didn't have a cell phone with me, and my feet were not reliable, and had been screaming at me for several hours already. And if I screwed up either the ladder placement or the climb, I just might fall on the rocks and bust my head open, with no one the wiser. But these were the things to shove into the back of my mind. I got the ladder into position after moving some rocks that were easier to roll down the embankment than lift, and braced the rubber-covered metal feet as securely as I could in the muddy ground. However, the 8-foot ladder didn't reach the branch. Masha was on, and the rain was coming down harder by the moment, meaning each of the ladder's steps was getting more and more slippery. But these, too, were things to consider after the job was done. Climbing, I got the ladder's top step, threw my left arm around the tree's 10-inch trunk, and stretched my right arm out toward Masha, urging her my way. "Come on, Mosh," I said, but she made no move other than to look at me with the same detached, half-cognizant expression, one that I was now sure had to be a result of shock. "Come on, big, tough girl," I went on, trying to jog her mind. "It's me. You can do it. You got yourself up there, didn't you?" But then, looking at the thin branches she was spread out on, I remembered again that cats are perfectly capable of getting themselves into spots that they can't get out of. The most jams involve high places, like mostly famous trees. "Come on, baby," I said, involving high places, using a term of endearment that I reserved for particular moments. Early on in my life, it's been stigmatized for me by the adults in the world who use such infantile language too much when they weren't screaming at each other, and later I had only 2 girlfriends who used the word, one with me and almost every other male she knew, making it difficult to reciprocate, and one with whom it was distinctly different. I'd never thought to use it with my cat, but Masha was plainly unique. "Come on, girl," I went on, stretching my fingers out farther. "You can do this. Come here, and let's go home." At the last word, she finally made a few extremely tentative moves, testing whether or not she could indeed get herself at least turned around on the mesh of branches. Her agility in getting into the spot had been truly remarkable. But getting back, when she wasn't pumped up with chemicals, and I assume now, fleeing something was going to be much harder. So I hooked my left arm around a limb that stuck out by my head, which gave me about another foot of reach, and seeing that Masha grew encouraged, managing to creep closer to my hand. I had to be able to get my thumb on one side of her chest and my fingers on the other, so I could scoop her up and get her against my own torso. But first she had to creep just a half a foot closer. She tried very hard to do it, her face filling with more recognition as she seemed to realize what was happening and why. Ever so carefully, she crept. And finally, in one big move that I realized now might have ended up with a pair of us falling 10 or 12 feet to the ground, a height Masha would have survived easily, while my own chances would have been far dicier, I did sweep her up and tight against my chest, which immediately clung to with claws of all 4 feet. At first I didn't feel them, so hard was my adrenaline pumping with the realization that I still had to get us to the ground. Clutching Masha with my right arm, as she kept clinging to me, I got my left arm back around the tree trunk and reversed the climb, going slowly and just repeating to her, "There we go, there we go, just a minute more and we'll be safe." I don't think she bought a word of it until we were, but then all of a sudden we made it. Once on the ground safely and immediately heading back to the house, Masha shifted to her chest and stomach and were tight against me. Even as she kept her feet where they'd been, my own nervous system, meanwhile, had started to register her claws. "Ow! Okay," I said. "Ow, Mosh, it's okay now." I got my left arm under her as my right stayed wrapped around her, but she didn't seem particularly reassured. "I've got you, Mashi. You don't have to..." But then I saw her expression, eyes straining open, face overall never having looked so much like a kitten, turning her head toward the house and then her eyes back up to mine with an expression that was half, "Don't you drop me. You, along with, you are taking me home, right?" "Yes, we're going home," I almost panted in reply. "It's okay, girl. You're okay. It's all over. Whatever you've got, you're okay." But in reality, I was only on the verge of discovering just how much she'd gotten herself into. We got inside, and I leaned down so that she could get to the floor. I thought she'd go after her food, but instead, at a quick walk but not a run, she went straight upstairs and headed for the library, her favorite safe haven. I closed all the doors that I'd earlier left open for her to return through, meaning almost every door in the house, and then headed up after her. She'd made it to the middle of the library and then just laid herself out on her right side, clearly exhausted. I'd fetched a big towel because it was evident carrying her home that despite her triple coat and the cover of maple leaves, she was soaked through with what I thought was just rainwater. But after I mopped up some of the water on her outer coat, I felt beneath it. The moisture closer to her body was different and very warm. Sweat? She'd been through something, all right, enough to create a lot of perspiration, which is rare for cats. In addition, at her rear, there was a fairly strong glandular scent, like the ones cat released when stressed or in a fight to ward off enemies. I kept gently stroking away what I could, which ordinarily would have annoyed her. Cats, of course, like to do their own personal cleaning themselves. But the towel seemed to be giving her some kind of reassurance, and eventually what I'd done with that little one, I laid the lightly and slightly damp, mostly dry roll of terry cloth on the floor next to her, just in case she wanted something to sink her claws into and to knead. I stroked the back of her neck, and soon enough she did move, but just enough to turn her head and glance at me, still exhausted, yet clearly returning from her somewhat dissociative state. Then she put her head back down. And glancing along her body, I saw the first of two very alarming things. In her left thigh was a round puncture wound, not huge, but also not the work of another cat. It was as if she'd been stabbed with a large knitting needle. Yet the wound was not bleeding. It might have been several hours ago, but now it was just there, staring back at me and looking angry. "Oh, Mosh," I said softly, "what happened here?" My first thought was a coyote, but if a coyote had gotten in close enough to make such a wound, it would likely have been not so neat. When I'd been living at the cottage, a coyote had appeared in the middle of the day, all too close to Suki, who herself hunting didn't see it. This had been doubly bad, but not only was there a danger to Suki herself, but also the coyote that allowed himself to be observed in a wide open pasture in a plain daylight are too often diseased, perhaps even rabid, which forced me into shooting the thing, a step I hated taking, but it was just too risky. And on inspecting the carcass, I saw why these animals, these wild canines, had such a reputation. The teeth were remarkably sharp, set in rows back from the fangs, and possessing a collective edge like a very sharp serrated blade. If a coyote had gotten a bite into Masha, therefore, the wound would have been much more ragged and destructive, like those in deer carcasses I'd encountered in the woods after the coyotes had finished them off. Not something one ever wants to experience. What I was seeing, therefore, was definitely odd. Feeling carefully, I began to check and see if there was any further mark on Masha, and eventually, as she lay on the floor in a surprisingly submissive way, I found one. High up on her belly, between her lower ribs, was another similar puncture wound like this small one. Like the first one, it was not bleeding, not anymore. That is, but it was disturbingly open. I didn't get it. She had been bitten twice? Or were these some kind of large claw punctures? Certainly, I was not thinking clearly enough to make complete sense of it. I could only lean back on my haunches, noticing for the first time just how painful my own feet and legs were, then sighing with tremendous concern. Had these wounds punctured any of her inner organs? Was that why she was so sedate? Or was she simply exhausted? And what did the larger wound in her thigh portend for her arthritis? And above all, since it was only the beginning to grow light outside by this point, what could I possibly do to help her for the next couple of hours until it was late or early enough to call her vet? I felt her nose, her ears, and her head. The nose was moist and cool, ears the same, and the head was not overheated. Her overall body temperature seemed normal. So I didn't think any infection was setting in, though it might have been too early to make that call. But she was comfortable enough, and even though I didn't notice at first, she had started to purr perceptibly as I stroked her, although that could have been from pain. But it didn't have the deep sound of the painful purr. Her eyes, meanwhile, were clearer and more cognizant, so I leaned down and murmured, "Mash, do you want food?" She picked her head up a bit. "Yeah? Upstairs, food?" She had known what I meant by such location references ever since I'd started leaving her alternative feedings when I had to leave for the day and into the evening. "Okay," I said, petting her a few more times, then standing and realizing that I too was pretty soaked. "I'll go get it. And some water, too. I bet you need water." Her tail flicked once, I suspected more at the thought of being served without having to shift than at the idea of water, and I hobbled quickly out across the gallery to the stairs. I got changed, then got some medication for my own pain, wishing I had something for hers, my own, of course, being an acetaminophen compound, which could be lethal to her even in a trace dose. Acetaminophen is shockingly toxic to cats. But I did get her food and considered the idea of forcing her to take one of the anti-inflammatories I'd gotten her. But knowing what she'd been through and all that, she really didn't like to take them even when she was feeling stronger. I let it go and just returned to the library with a bowl of food and a bowl of water. These I put just a couple of feet from her head to see if she would or could get up and get to them, and although it was a bit of a tired struggle, she did. She didn't seem to be favoring her left leg too much, if at all, so I figured that the creakiness was just part of her exhaustion. Her appetite, as always, was voracious, and she wolfed down the food, drank quite a bit of water, then returned to the floor in the towel, which she put her forepaws on. I was sitting in the library chair close by, and she looked up at me, her eyes much clearer, with something resembling an expectant expression. "What?" I said. "You've got something else in mind for tonight?" I got on the floor with her and lay down. "What do you say we both get a little sleep? Then we'll call the doctor." She wasn't crazy about the last word, but she seemed to like the first suggestion, and so we lay there together on the carpet, herself soon drifting off and me trying but unable to get there. Instead, I watched her as she slept next to me, appreciating anew, especially given the circumstances, how her breath made her big chest heave, how much her shoulders lifted at the same time, indeed, how very powerful, despite her arthritic self, she actually was. And as I watched her, I was reminded again of the only other cat I'd had who survived such mortal adventures, a cat who'd been as big and tough as Masha, if less outwardly beautiful and graceful. And as thoughts of that cat seemed to ease my mind, I indulged them while Masha began to snore delicately, secure in her home, if still with injuries that needed investigation. Those more comforting thoughts of that other cat, however, soon made me just a bit uneasy. Masha was home, alive, and healthy enough to eat and rest. All that was true, but her injuries were such that, I believed, the vet could tend to them. But there was a deeper question about her nature at work here, and thinking back, I could only hope that this episode had been a one-off, and that she was not going to be, as that earlier cat had been, a creature born in the wild and therefore indelibly drawn to the dangerous adventure. A creature, that is, for whom the lure of the defending against all intruders as well as seeking every outside risk exploit was going to prove, at times went on, more and more irresistible. And so I thought back further, to try to remember any hopeful lessons from those many years ago, and from that cat who was undoubtedly the most like Masha of all of those whom I'd ever lived with. And that's chapter 13, From My Beloved Monster, Masha, the half-wild rescue cat who rescued me, by Caleb Carr. Next week, we'll read chapter 14, City for Conquest. Our next reading comes from Best Friends Newsletter, Fall 2024. The article is titled Teamwork in Tennessee. The program ended ahead of schedule, and the life-saving continues. Only when we work together will we save them all. That belief is at the heart of Best Friends and our work across the country. To see that life-saving collaboration firsthand, you just have to look at our National Shelter and Bed program. Made possible in part by a grant from Maddie's Fund, through the Embed program, Best Friends works hand-in-hand with shelters nationwide to help save more lives. Depending on the shelter's need, we help them implement programs, gain community support, build a volunteer and foster base, and more. And boy, do these programs work. In fact, in Tennessee, the Embed program worked so well that it ended 3 months early. Last May, the Rhea County Animal Shelter in Tennessee took part in the Embed program, and right from the start, the shelter staff was enthusiastic to jump in and see how things could be improved. They engaged with the community to gain more volunteers, creating fun programs like Doggy Day Out that invited people to take their dogs on outings for a day. They also worked to find homes faster for easy-to-place dogs, freeing up more time for them to work with dogs with behavioral issues, dogs like Pluto. Pluto is such a doll of a dog, but at 3 months old, he was scared of everything, including people. To help him find a home, the shelter staff would need to spend extra time with him to gain his trust and show him that people weren't so bad after all. And now they all had created a program to give extra time to dogs just like him. That's exactly what they could do. It took training, exercises, and sometimes just sitting with him, but eventually they did gain Pluto's trust, and after spending a few months in a foster home, he finally blossomed. At 5 months old, Pluto found his adoptive family. Pluto going home wasn't the only maker or marker of success for the shelter. Because of their dedication, their save rate rose from 70% the month that embedded program began to more than 90% in November. And in February 2024, that save rate hit an incredible 100%. Having achieved their goal so quickly meant the one-year embed program would end in just 9 months. That's great news, but it certainly didn't mean the life-saving efforts would end. To sustain life-saving, they added a new shelter manager position made possible by a one-year funding commitment from Best Friends, and that means they'll be in a better position to keep life-saving programs going and continue saving more lives into the future. This article teamwork in Tennessee, the program ended ahead of schedule, and the life-saving continues. A big, tiny rescue. This pint-sized pup's life went from rocky road to smooth sailing. More than 100 tiny snoots and wiggly tails, more than 100 chihuahuas all in need of help. That's what Socorro County Animal Control came across in just one house in New Mexico, and it just so happened that a best friend staff member was lending a hand at a nearby shelter when she got the news, so naturally she offered to help. When it comes to hoarding situations and other large-scale rescue efforts, no single organization can or should do it alone. After all, collaboration is the only way that we're going to make the country no-kill in 2025. That's why Best Friends stepped in to take 17 of the dogs, including a few seniors, adults, and moms and their pups. All 17 seemed to be in pretty good shape, so once they arrived at the sanctuary, caregivers took their time moving them into comfy enclosures, giving them all the TLC that they needed to settle in. And everything seemed to be going smoothly, until one caregiver, Kimmy Grimes, heard a mama dog named Cora whining frantically. I looked over and I could see that one of the puppies seemed to be seizing, says Kimmy. She was rolling around like she wasn't in control of her body movements. A few seconds, she went completely limp and stopped breathing. Though it's incredibly scary to see someone so tiny in peril, Kimmy kept her cool and immediately went to work bringing the puppy named Pioneer back to life. Giving her gentle sternum rubs, eventually Pioneer's pulse returned and she let out a breath. She was whisked to the clinic, where veterinarians stabilized her. After a bit of care and time, the scary situation did indeed calm, and Pioneer soon returned to her curious, cuddly self, and from there she was returned to the warmth of her mom. The next day she was off to a foster home, where along with her mom and siblings, she'd get the attention and the time she needed to find a new home. This article, A Big Tiny Rescue. This pint-sized pup, life went from rocky road to smooth sailing. These articles all come from the Best Friends Animal Newsletter, the Fall 2024 edition. Our next article, Dog Not Eating, Possible Causes and Appetite Solutions. The article was reviewed by Dr. Amy Flowers. Whether you've had a pet dog for years or you've just adopted your first puppy, it can be very distressing when your dog won't eat. There are a variety of reasons for the loss of appetite in dogs. It's important to determine the cause in order to design the best treatment plan. The first thing to keep in mind is how you're judging your dog's appetite. If you're concerned because your dog isn't eating as much as the guidelines state on the food you purchased, remember that these are only averages. Many perfectly healthy dogs eat only 60 to 70% of the amount stated on the packaging. Because loss of appetite in dogs can indicate illness, it is important to seek veterinary care if you notice changes in your dog's eating habits. Even though most dogs do go a couple of days without food with no significant bad effects, it is best to address the problem as early as possible. Reasons your dog won't eat. Illness. A decreased appetite in dogs is often a sign of sickness, especially if your dog is exhibiting other symptoms at the same time. Although loss of appetite in dogs doesn't necessarily indicate serious disease, prompt veterinary attention is important because it could be a sign of significant illness, including cancer, various systemic infections, pain, liver problems, and kidney failure. Dental disease. Your dog may not want to eat because something in its mouth is causing pain. Having a broken tooth or a loose tooth or severe gingivitis or even an oral tumor. Sometimes these can happen below the gum line, so they cannot be seen like a tooth root abscess. Travel and unfamiliar surroundings. If your dog's appetite was fine until you went on a trip with them or moved to a new location, it may be that your dog won't eat because of traveling or unfamiliar surroundings. Some animals may get motion sickness, and others become nervous or uncomfortable in new places. Pickiness or behavior issues. Some dogs are just picky, or their refusal to eat may be caused by feeding them in a situation where they're uncomfortable, such as around aggressive dogs or from a bowl at an uncomfortable height. Because a decreased appetite in dogs may be caused by illness, never assume that your dog is picky without investigating other possibilities at first. What to do if your dog won't eat. What can you do to help your dog who won't eat will depend upon what you and your veterinarian determine. If your dog's lack of appetite is caused by illness, the vet may recommend a prescription diet to meet your pet's nutritional needs while the underlying disease is being addressed. Sometimes these diets are not particularly tasty, especially if your dog is used to regular treats or people food. If your dog is already ill, never starve your pet in an attempt to force it to eat the prescribed diet. Instead, talk with your veterinarian about alternatives. In more severe cases, your vet may prescribe appetite-stimulating medication, recommend syringe feeding, a liquid diet, or inserting a feeding tube. If your dog's decreased appetite is a behavior problem caused by pickiness or discomfort with mealtime, rather than the result of a medical condition, there are a number of things that you can do to encourage your pet to eat. These include cutting back on treats, feeding your pet on a regular schedule twice a day, making mealtime a fun time for your pet, such as playing with a toy that dispenses food or rewarding your dog with food for doing the trick, taking your dog for a walk before mealtime, changing your dog's feeding situation. If you normally feed your pet with other animals, try feeding them alone, or try using different bowls or plates at different heights to see what your dog prefers. Trying a different kind of food, such as canned food, if you normally feed your dog dry food. Add a bit of warm water to your dog's kibble to make it more appealing. All these suggestions come from the article, Dog Not Eating: Possible Causes and Appetite Solutions. The article was reviewed by Dr. Amy Flowers. Well, that completes our readings for today. I do hope you've enjoyed the stories, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce Vesper for Sun Sounds of Arizona and for Animal Companions. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.